Father, thank you for this time to gather together as your people. Thank you for this time to open your word and to study it together. I pray that you would bless this time, that you would protect us from my words and help us to hear yours and to see them and to apply them to our lives and to our Bible reading and everything else. I pray that this time would be for your glory and for your glory alone. In Christ's name, amen. All righty. So last time, we kind of started talking a little bit about the Gospels. And we didn't really get past the genealogy piece of it. So, I guess as we get started, one of the things that's always interesting to me with the Gospels is the title. So there isn't a title that's attached to them. So like if you go find one of the ancient manuscripts or whatever, they're untitled, they're no authorship that's like written on the top of it. But throughout history, you have a series of titles that are assigned to each of the four Gospels, right? Does anybody know what those are? Even if you open your Bible today. Well, so we typically refer to them as Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Well, you have the Synoptic Gospels that are Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Basically, it just means that they critical scholarship believes that they were written at the same time. They share a lot of material between them. But if you open to, say, Matthew, what's the title at the top of Matthew? No? Yes. So what we see at the top of every one of these is the gospel according to Matthew, the gospel according to Mark, the gospel according to Luke, the gospel according to John. I'll go ahead and throw that one in there too. And so the point is that there's one gospel. There's four witnesses. There's four different accounts. There are things between them that they're trying to emphasize differently. And yet, there is one gospel. And so the titles that the church has given to these books accordingly basically say that there is one gospel, even though we speak of gospels or of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John today. And so I think just to kind of cut through that shorthand a little bit is helpful for us sometimes to remember that at the end of the day, we're looking at one thing. Yes, we've got different perspectives on it, and yet there's a common core there that we need to be striving to see. So, generally speaking, I guess, so the Gospels are narratives, right? They're telling us a story. Some people would like to say that the Gospels are biographies. You ever heard that? Okay. So they're telling the story of the life of Jesus, right? And so people want to say they're biographies. And yet, if we say that they're just normal biographies, they're kind of strange books. Because they don't really tell us much about the first 30 years or so of Christ's life. They tell us a fair bit about the 3 years, or we'll say a little bit less than 3 years, after he starts his ministry. And then they tell us a whole lot about the last month, week of his life. And so it's very disproportionately weighted, right? So I guess the question becomes, kind of what's the focal point of the Gospels? It's supposed to be a softball. A little more specifically. Yeah, so kind of the passion narrative, the crucifixion and the resurrection. And we get just this huge focus on those parts within the gospel, right? So, for example, Matthew gets the first prediction of the crucifixion and the resurrection in Matthew 16. That's like halfway through the gospel of Matthew. It goes to chapter 28. And we see that kind of continues in the other gospels. Where by the time you get to John, you can argue that you get the first prediction of Christ's crucifixion and resurrection in John 2. And so it's just this overwhelming theme within the Gospels. And actually so much so that at times you'll hear people say something to the effect of the Gospels are essentially passion narratives with extended introductions. That's just so much the core of what's meant in the Gospels. And I guess while we're kind of touching on that subject, particularly if you have unbelieving friends and whatnot who are a little bit headier, we'll say, you may start hearing about things like the Gospel of Thomas or the Gospel of Judas or Judas or one of those other apocryphal Gospels. And one of the things that I think we have to look at is kind of the similarities and the differences between the two. There's date issues with them, and there's authorship issues with them, and all this other stuff. There's content issues with a lot of them. But even more so, within that content issue bucket, one of the differences, like the Gospel of Thomas, is a collection of sayings. So it's not telling us a story about Christ, and it's certainly not focused on the gospel, the focus on, you know, that extended focus on Christ's crucifixion and resurrection. And so for all of those reasons, that gospel gets rejected. And there are very good reasons, because it doesn't follow the pattern of the gospel, according to anyone else. So, if you would, let's open to Matthew 16. We're going to start at verse 13, and we're going to read a little bit of an extended chunk here. It's not actually in my notes here, but it would probably help if I gave you a little bit of an explanation of what we're doing. So, if you remember way, way back, we started out in Genesis 1, and we talked about how God is the king of the world. He's the ultimate king. Everything is ultimately under his sovereignty. And yet he created humanity as his vice regents. They're supposed to exercise God's reign over this creation. And yet instead they rebel. And in that rebellion we have the creation that exercises sovereignty over God's vice regents, who then in turn try to exercise sovereignty over God himself. And so that's the quintessential piece of that rebellion. And so because of that, then there are curses that flow out of that. And yet there's also this promise of that the curse will be reversed. And so we talked a little bit about the idea of the promised seed. And we've kind of been tracing that through the scriptures. And so we followed it through Genesis. And eventually we found ourselves at David as part of that line. And we've been following that through. And then last week we kind of picked up with that again with the genealogies themselves, although I didn't use that term. So we see then that Christ is this promised seed, as well as the Messiah. And so now we need to see, what does that mean? What does that look like? Because one of the things we're going to see here today, and this is kind of one of my main focal points for today, probably the main focal point for today, is that by the time we get to Christ's day, people don't have, that they haven't connected this. They haven't put anything together, really. So with that said, let's start with Matthew 16, verse 13. And we're going to read through 17, 13 eventually, but we'll do it kind of in chunks. So, 16, 13. Now when Jesus came into the district of Caesarea Philippi, he was asking his disciples, "Who do people say that the Son of Man is?" And they said, "Well, some say John the Baptist, and others Elijah, but still others Jeremiah or one of the prophets." He said to them, "But who do you say that I am?" Simon Peter answered, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." And Jesus said to him, "Blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah, because flesh and blood did not reveal this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. I also say to you that you are Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades will not overpower it. I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven, and whatever you bind on earth shall have been bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth shall have been loosed in heaven. Then he warned the disciples that they should tell no one that he was the Christ. So I'm not going to deal with every detail of this passage. You're welcome to ask questions, because there's some interesting verses on there. But a couple of points before we get there. So Caesarea Philippi is kind of an interesting setting for this story. Caesarea Philippi is a Gentile city. It's a Roman city, but it's populated predominantly with Gentiles. And so it's interesting because Christ chooses here to talk about this issue of being the Messiah. And by the time that Peter answers, he even goes further than necessarily just Messiah to Son of God. And so, I guess one question, and I've kind of hinted at the answer a little bit, just as a FYI, is why might Christ have been more inclined to speak about the issue of the Messiah in Caesarea Philippi, in a Gentile area? That's okay. We'll read the next little chunk and come back to it. So, verse 21, from that time, Jesus began to show his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things from the elders and chief priests and scribes and be killed and be raised up on the third day. Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him, saying, God forbid it, Lord, this shall never happen to you. But he turned to Peter and said, get behind me, Satan. You are a stumbling block to me, for you are not setting your mind on God's interests, but man's. So, this story probably needs a little bit of explanation. So, what's going on here is, we've just had Peter confessing to Christ that he is the Messiah. And yet, he doesn't have the whole picture. He's got this warped view of who the Messiah is. And so what we see is, like, even in extra-biblical literature from the time, you had a lot of people who were even, say, I guess, viewing two Messiahs. And so we talked about how you have one Messiah who's this reigning, kingly Messiah, and that's the one that they think Jesus is. And yet they don't have that category of the suffering servant Messiah, that category of the crucified and risen Messiah. And so that word doesn't mean to them what it means to us. Because it's hard for us to assign or to say the word Messiah without picturing that crucifixion and resurrection and the dealing with sin and all of these things. Whereas the Jews of Second Temple Judaism, the Jews of Jesus' day, were looking for a triumphant Messiah, a conquering Messiah, a militaristic king, essentially, who would come in and overthrow the land, a new David. He would overthrow the Romans. He would kick them out of the land and establish the new kingdom of Jerusalem, and they would go back to the first monarchy, essentially. So, all that said, why would Jesus maybe have been more interested in talking about issues of being the Messiah in a Gentile area? They were pagans, so they didn't have that messianic hope. Does that make sense, Kim? Okay, yeah. Yep. So the Gentiles didn't have all of that Messiah language and Messiah concepts and history that the Jews did to that point. Yeah, Absolutely. You were going to say something?
Yeah, they didn't have the preconceived notions that Jews would have had.
Right? Yeah.
But you just said that.
Yeah.
In different words. So.
Okay.
That's what Kim said. So,
yeah. Yep. So, I guess within that context, we see that there's very mixed understandings of who Jesus is, right? And so, like in the first section we just read, who is Christ, or who is the Son of Man, is the way Matthew asked the question. In Mark and Luke, I think it's just, who am I? Who is it that people say I am? Either way, the point is, who is Jesus? Well, it's kind of interesting, right? Because they're hearing answers like John the Baptist, Elijah, Jeremiah, one of the prophets. And so what we see is that people are witnessing the works of Christ. They're witnessing all of these wonderful things that are happening that he's doing. And yet, that they don't quite know what to make of him. He's doing all of these wonderful things, so he must be sent by God, but he doesn't transcend the prophets in their mind. And we'll see this again a little bit later. And the other thing is, So again, we talked about kind of the triumphalistic hopes, the hopes of the overthrow of Rome. And yet in God's economy, everything flips on its head, right? And so, the Messiah is the suffering Messiah. He's the crucified and risen Messiah. And so while everyone else is looking for this worldly, victorious, conquering king, they don't see that he's right in their midst. So we're going to skip 24 to 28 and pick up in 17, and we'll come back to 24 to 28. So, 17, starting at verse 1, we're told that 6 days later, Jesus took with him Peter and James and John, his brother, and led them up on a high mountain by themselves. And he was transfigured before them. And his face shone like the sun, and his garments became white as light. And behold, Moses and Elijah appeared to them, talking with him. Peter said to Jesus, "Lord, it is good for us to be here. If you wish, I will make 3 tabernacles here, one for you and one for Moses and one for Elijah." While he was still speaking, a bright cloud overshadowed them, and behold, a voice out of the cloud said, "This is my beloved Son, with whom I am well pleased. Listen to him." When the disciples heard this, they fell down to the ground and were terrified. And Jesus came to them and touched them and said, "Get up and do not be afraid." And lifting up their eyes, they saw no one except Jesus himself alone. As they were coming down from the mountain, Jesus commanded them, saying, "Tell the vision to no one until the Son of Man has risen from the dead." And the disciples asked him, "Why then do the scribes say that Elijah must come first?" And he answered them, "Elijah is coming and will restore all things. But I say to you that Elijah already came, and they did not recognize him, but did to him whatever they wished. So also the Son of Man is going to suffer at their hands." Then the disciples understood that he had spoken to them about John the Baptist. So, what happens in the Transfiguration? Kind of a loaded question. So, in the Transfiguration, Jesus and a select number of the disciples go up on the mountaintop. And the select number of disciples, I guess the way you would look at it is kind of the inner circle of Jesus, watch as Jesus is transfigured. He's transformed before their eyes. And he's there with Elijah and Moses, who are, I don't know, probably two of the biggest heroes of the Jewish faith. Very fair statement. And Peter offers to build three tabernacles, three tents is the idea. One for each. So, and we, once Peter makes that offer, we hear the voice of God crying out for the distinctiveness of Christ. Why? Mm-hmm. I think that's in John somewhere. Talking about John the Baptist. Yeah, I think if I remember right, it's the passage where Christ tells John the Baptist, or Christ is speaking of John the Baptist and says that no one born of women is greater than he because he testified to Christ.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was referenced to John.
Yeah. Sure. I think the focus for me, at least, is more on the three. So they're offering to build three tabernacles. One for Moses, and one for Elijah, and one for Christ. Which makes Christ the same as Elijah and Moses. And that's such a... And so what it does is it gives us this understanding of how it is that even Jesus' own inner circle of disciples viewed Jesus. And so this whole section of what we're looking at here keeps giving us these pictures over and over and over again of just how much even the disciples didn't understand who Christ was and what he came to do. Well, and even there, I think the disciples themselves, what Peter says is true, it's wonderfully true, and yet what he means by it is not what we mean by it. And so he spoke better than he knew. In part, I would say so. He's showing them these things to prepare them for down the line, right? And so, even in this passage right here, we're told, tell this to no one, tell the vision to no one until the Son of Man has risen from the dead. Keep this to yourself. So he's preparing them for down the line, and yet, even they don't understand it. This is 17:1-13, basically, for those who joined. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
So it's as if they're being taught.
Yep.
But God's using the means of these miraculous, like the transfiguration and...
Mm-hmm. Well, and even as they're being taught, there's still these preconceived notions that color the way that they're taught. And so they still don't get it. And so by the time we get to the crucifixion, what do they do once Christ dies? They go cower in a room, terrified that they're going to be next. They still don't have a category for a crucified and resurrected Messiah, even though Christ has told them to expect it, repeatedly and explicitly. Yeah, and so if you remember back over the last month and a half, however long it's been, we were talking about the servant songs, and we talked about how, like in the first servant song in particular, it's clearly a ruling servant. It's a king. And by the time we get to the third and the fourth in particular, he's clearly a suffering servant. And so what do you do with these revelations? Well, frequently what they did with them is they split them. Because kings don't suffer. Generally. There's a couple in the Bible, but generally speaking, kings don't suffer. and they certainly don't suffer voluntarily. And so how can this greater David possibly wind up on a cross? You know, I mean, even Paul later on quotes from Deuteronomy and says, cursed is anyone who hangs on a tree. A little bit out of context, but pretty close. And so they offer to build three tents and make Jesus just another one of the prophets. Because that's the way they view him. He's this great triumphalistic Messiah, and yet, in some sense, so were these other great prophets who worked all these miracles and helped to usher in the kingdom and led the people through the wilderness and brought in the law and all of these wonderful acts of the grace of God showing into the life of his covenant people to that point. And yet, it's so egregious that we get God speaking from heaven. This is my son in whom I am well pleased. Listen to him. He's not just another prophet. And so, like we were saying, this isn't just true of Jesus' inner circle. If his own inner circle has this level of misperception about who he is, what do you think the level of the people in Jerusalem are misperceiving about who he is? Because they're going to be far less aware of who he is and what he's done than the people who were there for it, right? The people who are receiving this separate teaching from the crowds that's explaining what he taught the crowds. And so, tell no one of this vision until the Son of Man rises from the dead. And then it gets even more kind of turned on its head, right? So we're going to go back now to 24 to 28 of chapter 16. where Jesus says to his disciples, "If anyone wishes to come after me, he must deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever wishes to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. For what will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and forfeits his soul? Or what would a man give in exchange for his soul? For the Son of Man is going to come in the glory of his Father with his angels, and will then repay every man according to his deeds. Truly I say to you, there are some who are standing here who will not taste death until they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom." So, a lot going on there. But the first piece of that is that the kingdom is upside down, right? We kind of mentioned that briefly. So this Messiah, the Messiah of Messiahs, right? The greatest that there could possibly be Messiah is telling us that he's going to a cross. He will be crucified, dead, buried, and rise from the dead on the third day. And now he's telling his disciples, if you are to be my disciple, you will too. The least will be greatest, and the greatest will be least. And it's not necessarily just a simple, this is not the greatest passage to talk about this complexity of it, but it's not necessarily just a simple reversal of fates, right? So it's not that the rich people are going to get it bad and the poor people are going to get it so great and all of this. We can go talk about that from like Lazarus and the rich man and those kind of passages. But there is something of that. It's that the things that we naturally desire in this world, that this world kind of lends itself to us desiring, aren't the measure of God's favor. And that's kind of the important piece here, is even when Christ rebukes Peter for correcting Christ wrongly, what does he say? You are not setting your mind on God's interests, but man's. And even that's kind of an ironic statement, right? Because at the end of the day, God's interests are man's interests. It's only through Christ doing that that anyone is saved. Even John the Baptist sends messengers to Jesus. Are you the Christ, or should we wait for someone else? Yeah, and so then we get to verse 28, which is going to be kind of my launching off point for next week. But so I'll say a little quick thing about it. And then we'll probably wrap up. I'll open it up for questions, although I won't go in too much detail on that particular verse. So verse 28, "Truly I say to you, there are some of you here, or there are some of those who are standing here who will not taste death until they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom." Striking statement. And certainly it seems to be an eschatological statement, right? It's talking about the end times, right? I'm going to say yes and no. When does the Son of Man come in his glory? becomes the crux of this question. And this is something we're going to be talking about over the next couple of weeks. But I'm going to contend that the point of the greatest glory of Christ is when he's hanging on that cross. It's the point where we see the love of God and the judgment of God the most strongly. But I don't want to leave that completely uncovered. I'll unpack that here in the coming weeks. Question? Oh, okay. Alrighty, so that being said, I'll open it up for questions. Like I said, I know there's a couple of kind of controversial verses in this chunk. Yes and no. I mean, on the one hand, it almost gets treated as the same event in later writers. And yet, then, like in Mark specifically, Mark doesn't even cover the resurrection, which is just striking. I mean, depending on where you think Mark ends, most likely I don't think Mark actually covered the resurrection. Not to say that the resurrection isn't important, but again, I'll go into it next week more. What's that?
Could you just keep continue or not?
So I'm expecting a big class next week. So, yeah, so 27 and 28... The Son of Man is going to come in the glory of his Father with his angels and will then repay every man according to his deeds. Truly I say to you, there are some of those who are standing here who will not taste death until they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom. I think the verse divides, or those two verses divide somewhat. And again, this is way more than we have time to go into right now. But it's kind of... You'll hear people talk about the already and the not yet. I think it's in that rubric that we have to understand that passage. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's certainly one way to look at it. I think temporally it's split. So kind of how we talked about in like the prophets, you get the metaphor of like the mountains, where from a distance it almost seems like everything's a plain, and yet when you get close into it, you start seeing that there's actually much more distance there than you think. I think this passage is one of those that does that as well.
Okay. What do you call that?
Yeah, I'll make up a term if you want.
No.
Yep. It goes back way more than me. I got about 7 minutes, so. Yep. Okay.
This tie in any way with the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple in 87?
The way that I typically read it, let me reread it just to make sure before I open my mouth here. Oh, I flipped passages. I'm actually going to answer that no. I know that's a really common view, where a lot of the preterist type folks, one of the views of eschatology talks about everything basically, or views a lot of eschatology as having happened by 70 AD. I'm not necessarily in that camp. This passage in particular, I think, really is dealing with particularly 28, which is what they say corresponds with the fall of Jerusalem. I'm saying corresponds with the crucifixion of Christ. Yep. And I'll defend that more next week. Pastor Greg? Yeah. Yep. Yep. Yeah, and I will say that I do think that there are some passages later on in Matthew that do talk about the fall of Jerusalem. I just don't think this one does. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And essentially, I'm going to argue that when Christ goes to the cross, when he's raised up on the cross, it essentially functions as his coronation. Yeah, it's connected to it, and yet that's the event that's kind of the where it tips. Yeah. And it's also kind of the single event that is supposed to be referencing a broader picture. So I will try to do this with the least confusion possible. I will do my best. I can really confuse you with a chart. You may regret that request. All righty, so any other quick questions, or we'll close out with a word of prayer? All righty, let's pray.